Rigby picks up the rites in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Father Mackenzie, writing the words of the sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
People live their life in a dream, never really waking up to reality. Well, I suppose that statement presupposes that reality actually exists as a meaningful concept. What I mean by reality is that, that thing that our shared perceptions identify and in some similar way. Forget it. Sounds like one of those stoned rambles I used to get on. It's been a long time since I tried any of that stuff. Quite straight tonight. Depressingly straight, even. At least in terms of the way I used to think. So, where was I? Oh, yeah. I was talking about the way lots of people live their lives in a dream. Just like Eleanor Rigby. Many, perhaps most Americans live their lives in a dream. They've been sucked into a belief in an American dream that's made from money and possessions and power. Visible accomplishments, instant gratification. That's the American way. Well, that's what they want you to believe is the American way. But that's not what Mike and I believe. We have a new American dream where cooperation trumps competition and loving your neighbor is the order of the day. We don't think it's crazy to dream about that kind of America. We think it's crazy not to have this kind of dream. We think it's crazy to fall for the lies. We think the government, the cops, the establishment, they're the crazy ones. We want to set things right. This is our new American dream. On this Valentine's Day 2013, we challenge all of you to dream with us. Dream of love, of forgiveness, of understanding. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and I'm proud now to turn it over to my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Brian Panhusen and James Fetzer. Tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Toronto, Madison, Wisconsin, and wherever you are. I've never been one to say that I love my country. I just don't understand the concept, I guess. The flag, the anthem, fighters streaming over the stadium, they just fill me with disgust. I did once love a 56 black and white Chevy station wagon, and I had a summer romance with Strawberry Hill all back in the 70s. Oh, what a night. But I guess I really do love how some people in this country take it upon themselves to care enough to work very hard to give us the truth about our history. I guess I'm talking about conspiracy theorists. That's a derogatory term these days, like liberal has been. But there have been hundreds of these people, and they have worked on everything for us. It's a gift they give to us, like the internet, I guess. How did this get here? It's cool, though. Wow. If we didn't have these people, we would be left with only knowing what the people who control our information want to tell us. And that's not nearly enough. One of those people who are trying to help us is Professor Jim Fetzer, who has worked for years on such cases as the JFK murder, 9/11, Wellstone, and now Sandy Hook. He's agreed to join us each month as a columnist. We'll be hearing Professor Fetzer's second installment with us later in the show. Okay, I just want to mention something, some news about recent drone protests. This isn't recent, but Brian Terrell, he lives in Iowa. He's a Catholic worker. He did a protest, I think it was over the summer, at Whiteman Air Force Base, and I believe that's in Missouri. He reported, I think it was in December, he reported for a six-month sentence at the Yankton Federal Prison, Yankton, South Dakota. I think he's due out in May. Yankton is not so far from where I'm from, around in Nebraska. And I also want to mention this. Nine people arrested blocking of the gate to Hancock Drone Murder Base in upstate New York, and I'll just read a little bit from the release. Nine opponents of killing human beings with missiles shot from drones were arrested on Wednesday, nonviolently interfering with the drone kill program at Hancock Air Base near Syracuse, New York. Their nine arrested for disturbing the war were Matt Ryan, Carmen Trotta, Nancy Gowan, Bill Pickard, Bill Streit, Jim Clune, Ellen Grady, Linda Leetender, and Mary Ann Grady Flores. It doesn't say if they're in custody, if they've been released, but that was just this past Wednesday, and it seems the drone protests are thankfully spreading across the country. A statement by upstate drone action member Jim Clune: the Reaper strikes and the United States killer drone policies have taken the lives of thousands in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere. These strikes are illegal and immoral. Under international agreements with which the U.S. has signed, the killing of civilians, extrajudicial murder, violation of national sovereignty, and violation of due process are illegal acts. And I'll stop right there, but for more, go to the website called warisacrime.org. Now back to you, Chuck.
Your toilet is plugged, and you know who did it. Al-Qaeda. You have a flat tire on the freeway. Yep, Al-Qaeda. You fall into a giant pothole as you turn off the freeway. You disappear for days, and who did it? You got it, Al-Qaeda. Your burrito is undercooked, and you get indigestion. There you go. Al-Qaeda strikes again. They are everywhere. Sleeper cells, caffeine cells, amoeba cells, Al-Qaeda, ninjas, ghosts, fairy tale characters. You've never seen them, but they are everywhere. This message brought to you by the United States of America, Department of Homeland Security. Have a nice day.
The New American Dream Radio Show is sponsored in part tonight by Greatest Generation Beer, brewed from the finest hops and barley something something. Look for the long-haired hippie on the red, white, and blue can, because it's not about killing just because somebody tells you to and not being smart enough to think for yourself. It's all about the courage to fight for what is really right. Greatest Generation Beer. It is actually great. Your DHS, which is to say that auditions for the upcoming terror season, are being held by crisis actors of the homeland in your local high school homeroom. Actors will be needed to portray experts who know instantly how large buildings come down and who did it. Actors will also be needed to play bereaved parents law enforcement officials, public officials, and medical examiners. We believe in make-believe democracy. We're crisis actors of the homeland. You better believe it.
And now, we bring you the Charles Bukowski Target and Walmart Valentine's Day Card Special American Collection. Tell those Americans around you what you really think. A card designed with you in mind. Some sample selections from the Bukowski Target Walmart Special American Collection.
I don't hate people, I just feel better when they're not around.
The best often die by their own hand, just to get away. And those left behind can never understand why anybody would ever want to get away from them.
Sometimes you climb out of bed in the morning and you think, I'm not going to make it. But you laugh inside, remembering all the times you felt that way. We're all going to die, all of us. What a circus. That alone should make us love each other, but it doesn't. We are terrorized and flattened by trivialities. We are eaten up by nothing. There is a loneliness in this world so great that you can see it in the slow movement of the hands of a clock. People so tired and mutilated, either by love or no love. People just are not good to each other one-on-one. The rich are not good to the rich. The poor are not good to the poor. We are afraid. Our educational system tells us that we can all be big-ass winners. It hasn't told us about the gutters or the suicides or the terror of one person aching in one place, alone, untouched, unspoken to, watering a plant.
Sometimes you just have to pee in the sink.
I couldn't get myself to read the want ads. The thought of sitting in front of a man behind a desk and telling him that I wanted a job, that I was qualified for a job, was too much for me. Frankly, I was horrified by life, at what a man had to do simply in order to eat, sleep, and keep himself clothed. So I stayed in bed and drank. When you drank, the world was still out there, but for the moment, it didn't have you by the throat. The fuckers? There, I feel better. Goddamn human race. There, I feel better. The problem was you had to keep choosing between one evil or another, and no matter what you chose, they sliced a little bit more off you until there was nothing left. At the age of 25, most people were finished. A whole goddamn nation of assholes driving automobiles, eating, having babies, doing everything in the worst way possible. Like voting for the presidential candidate, who reminded them most of themselves. The Charles Bukowski Target and Walmart Valentine's Day Card Special American Collection, a card designed with you in mind.
Our first guest tonight is Brian Panhusen, a writer from Toronto. And we're going to talk to him right now.
Hello.
Hello, Brian. It's Chuck Gregory.
Hey, Chuck. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too. Hey, I really enjoyed your novel, Night is a Shadow Cast by the World. And I'm hoping that we can tell the listeners a little bit about it and also how you came up with such an unusual concept. I'd like to start out with you introducing yourself.
Okay, Chuck, well, I appreciate it, and I'm pleased that you enjoyed the book. My name is Brian Panhusen. I am a writer who lives in Toronto, Canada. I've lived here all my life, was born here. I lived for a stint in Rochester, Minnesota for about a year when I was 10, but most of the time I've spent in Toronto. And this is my second book. My first book was a collection of short stories, which was published in 1999. It was called The Death of the Moon. And this, so Night of the Shadow is my second book, and I have a third book coming out in the fall. In fact, just this afternoon, I have been doing the edits on it that have been given to me by the editor. Night of the Shadow Cast by the World is a self-published book under the imprint of Tortoiseshell and Black, which was a small press that I actually ran a few years ago, and it had been dormant for a while, so I decided to publish this book myself. And the next book, however, is coming out with a mid-sized Canadian publisher called ECW Press.
Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. That book is called The Sky Manifest. It's actually quite different than this book. It's a lot more, it's sort of darker. This has a bit more of a light tone to it, Night as a Shadow, a bit more of an adventure, although it's serious in parts as well, as you know.
Well, our readers, our listeners will have no idea what the book's about, so why don't you give us a little synopsis?
Okay. When I tell people about the book, it's generally best to describe the opening chapter, because that's really what sets things in motion, and it's a bit of an unusual opening, a bit of a shocker for people. So if I just set the scene, we have a couple. Their names are Cordell and Marla Bichard. They live in a smallish house in a small town a few hours north of Toronto, and they are busy doing the dishes. Sort of quotidian scene of them doing the dishes and having a little discussion about the day. Cordell's a little bit agitated, and Marla notices this. Their house backs onto a fairly large field on the edge of this small town. And while they're having the conversation, suddenly something enormous thunders over the house. And Cordell rushes out into the backyard to determine what it was. And as Marla watches from the window, still finishing up the dishes, an airplane lands in the field behind the house. And it's a classic DC-3 Dakota, first flown in 1935. It's sort of the Art Deco airplane that you might see on an ashtray or something like that. Very classic aircraft, one of the most produced aircrafts in history. Very famous. The plane pulls to a halt behind the house, a door opens, and Cordell has a conversation with someone inside. Marla cannot see who it is. She only sees Cordell discussing something with this person. Then Cordell climbs up the steps of the aircraft. He pulls the door shut, and as Marla watches, the plane's engines power up, and it takes off. That is chapter one.
Well, I'll tell you. When I read that, I was hooked.
Well, good. That's the idea. I'm pleased. I mean, that's a very compelling. You know, I like to start. You know, I like to start my stories with a bang. You want to get people in right away. Yeah, and then there's a bit of a mystery. I'll just sort of describe. I won't really give too much away, but of course it's a mystery. Marla doesn't really know what's happened. Cordell happens to run a very eccentric bookstore, very popular in the small town, filled with books. A classic kind of used bookstore, new and used, very strange, creaky shelves, packed to the rafters, and. What she does is goes to the store and tries to find clues as to what may have happened, because of course she has no idea if Cordell has arranged this, if he, you know, if he knew this plane was going to land, or if it was a completely random act. And she does some investigation. There's a bit of a detective work on her part, and it takes a little while before we actually hook into Cordell's story and find out what really happened to him. So there you have it, without giving away too much, the basics for Night is a Shadow cast by the world.
Well, as you mentioned, you do eventually hook into Cordell's story.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the way that you you would switch from one character's point of view to the other only between chapters. So many writers tend to jump from one point of view to another, from just between paragraphs, and you end up getting so confused you don't know who's talking about what.
Right, right.
And you you did a great job of staying on top of that and keeping the reader, well, fascinated, I think.
Oh, well, thank you.
At least I was.
Thank you. In fact, the book, through its evolution, because it took quite a long time for me to write the original idea. In fact, I know precisely when the original idea came of, it was the opening scene. I was riding the subway in Toronto here. I was on my way. It was the year was 1998. And I was on my way on the subway to see the film Elizabeth. I think if you recall that sort of a very interesting film with somebody who we had just met, this new actress named Kate Blanchett. We hadn't seen her really in anything. It was like her first big role. And I remember I was going to meet some friends at the old York Cinema, which was a great theater, no longer here in Toronto anymore. And I was riding the subway, and I was working on my pilot's license, and I actually never did finish getting it because I ended up having kids and running out of money. Still my dream to finish getting, you know, the license and being able to fly on my own. But I had been struggling with another idea for a book, and I wanted to do one about aviation. And so this idea of the scene popped into my head about the husband just disappearing and what the mystery was. And, of course, I didn't know what the mystery was. I had to create it.
So you didn't plan the whole thing out in advance?
I didn't. I mean, at that moment, it was just that was the core of the idea. That was the seed that was planted, and I had to nurture it and make it grow into something. And it, you know, went through a lot of different drafts and ideas and things. And the point I was getting to was, because you were discussing splitting the two scenes, the original book actually had Marla's story told in its entirety, and then Cordell's story. So they weren't interleaved the way they were. And that had its own interest, because you have to read the entire story of Marla, what happens to Marla, before you knew anything about what happened to Cordell. And I had several friends who are writers. It's always good to have people who can give you their honest opinion. And a very good friend of mine, a writer named Jonathan Bennett, read it and said he loved the book, but there was this one problem, and that was it was just too stark a difference between the two. It felt like two completely different books. So he suggested that I interleave them, which was extremely difficult to do, but obviously something that I accomplished with Excel spreadsheets and all kinds of sort of technological tools to figure out where my scenes were going. It was color-coded, and actually looks quite attractive how I managed to bring it all together. But I like to kind of use technology when I can, even to write, and that's an example of where those tools came in handy.
That's what technology is for. It's to help. I think you did a marvelous job of interleaving the stories, and I suspect if I had read it the other way, I might have made the same suggestion as your writer friend.
Yep. Hey, can I ask you a question, Chuck?
Absolutely.
I'm curious on how, because this book is self-published and it hasn't had a lot of publicity or anything, so I'm wondering how you came across my book and how you came to read it.
You know, I don't honestly remember.
Oh, really?
I look for books that I can find and download free.
Right.
So I have like a Google alert for free ebooks or something like that.
Yep.
And I think this came up one day and I jumped on it. And unlike many of the books that I find that way, that I end up reading a few pages and deciding to skip to something else, this grabbed me and took me on a fascinating journey.
All right. Well, I'm pleased actually to hear, because it was a bit of a struggle for me whether or not I should make it free. It's on Amazon, and so I had to make it exclusive to Amazon, and then I can give it 5 free days. And the book was languishing a bit. It hadn't sold that much, and I thought, well, the really important thing to me, I'm not in this to make money. I'm very realistic about being a writer. I have a day job as well. I would love to be able just to write full time, but I'm, you know, not currently in that position. And so the important thing to me is to have people read the book. And it's been very good. I've managed to get the book out there quite a bit with it being free. And obviously this interview right now is happening because I made that offer. So I'm really pleased to know that that's working. And I can let the readers know that there are 2 more days that the book is going to be free. I haven't publicized that right now, but I'll give you an exclusive on your radio show, Chuck, on February 14th, which is, just a week from today, it will be free, and on February 21st. So So that would be the following week. It will be free on Amazon for download, so people can grab that for nothing and put it on their reader on their, you know, if they have a Kindle or an iPad or anything that has the Kindle app.
Well, great, and thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad also that you told me some of the thought process there in making it free. Because I've wondered the same thing. You know, I'm involved in some publishing and not of anything very successful. Well, successful in a literary standpoint, but not in terms of getting a lot of sales.
Right. Yeah, I know the feeling. It's a hard slog. I mean, it's very difficult, just especially with publicity when it comes to self-published books. So one problem, I mean, I think genre books definitely do better. There are people who read a lot of particular kind of book, like crime novels and vampire novels and things like that. And a lot of these people are very, they're very prolific readers. They consume a lot, so it's easy to get it out there. This book is a bit more literary, and that's a bit more of a difficult sell because your audience doesn't read sort of the volume that somebody in the genre fiction categories might read. And that's what I think I've come up against. It's hard to sort of categorize this book because it is literary, but it's also an adventure. I think when people hear the term literary, they think eating their vegetables. They're thinking of the broccoli, right? So I tried to make this book that it was literary, so it has merit in terms of the use of language. I try to use interesting language. I like to write innovative sentences. A friend of mine who read it commented, I think, on her Facebook status that it was delightfully free of cliché. And so I try to avoid clichés in it. I try to create my own tropes and keep things interesting.
Well, I thought it was very well structured, and the language was beautiful. It's kind of quirky in many ways,
mm-hmm.
and reminded me perhaps a bit of Douglas Copeland in that way.
Oh yeah, yes, he's also a Canadian writer, of course, from Vancouver. Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. So maybe it's something Canadian. Maybe you need to read more Canadian fiction.
Well, maybe that's it. Well, Brian, I've enjoyed visiting with you today, and I hope that you'll let me know when your next book becomes available.
Oh, yes.
And please remind our listeners where they can find the book, and both free and after it's not.
Okay, so the book title is Night is a Shadow Cast by the World, which incidentally it is. Night is a Shadow Cast by the World, so it's sort of my non-fiction title for my fictional book. And it's available from currently available as an ebook only from Amazon. However, after March 14th, it will be available again on the iBook store and Kobo store and a few other places as well. But it's currently exclusively available on Amazon free February 14th, February 21st. February 21st is my birthday. I thought I would leave it free on my birthday. And the 14th, of course, is Valentine's Day. So you could download it for free for your loved one if you like. It's also available as a paperback from Amazon. It's a little bit more expensive. It's $4 as an ebook and $20 from Amazon as a paperback. You can also get it from Lulu.com as a paperback. And so that's it.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, and have a good night.
Okay, you too. I appreciate it, Chuck. Nice talking to you.
We would like to congratulate this year's Golden Globe and Oscar nominees for Best Actor in a nationally televised false flag performance. 9/11 Harley Guy, Robbie Parker, H. Wayne Carver, and Gene Rosen. And also the nominees for Best Supporting Actor in a false flag performance. Anderson Cooper, Diane Sawyer, Piers Morgan, and Stephanopoulos Snuffleupagus. Congratulations to all of this year's winners. And now this. From the New American Dream, WTF, Bulletin Point, Bulletin Board. Adam Lanza, the little man... Adam Lanza, the little man firing a high-powered weapon inside a building. Nobody injured, all dead. Never was there such accuracy since way back on the St. Valentine's Day massacre, ordered by old Al Capone. Although, documents show that Adam Lanza died on December 13th, the day before the shootings even took place. A dead shot, and old Scarface Obama.
And now a message from the United Tribes, from the Algonquin to the Seminole to the Cherokee to the Lakota to the Apache. Americans, that's in air quotes, your time's up. Look what you've done. You're a disaster, the biggest there's ever been. Climate change, massacres, fascism, poverty, the whole manifest destiny westward expansion. You're always getting better, load of crap. Just keep it on moving. Right down the Golden Gate Bridge into the Pacific Ocean and just go away. And with the last American idiot to leave, please turn out the lights. Please exit through the gift shop. Our second guest, Jim Fetzer, isn't available just yet. I'm going to have Mike tell you a little bit about him while I try to get him.
Jim Fetzer is a McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He's also conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, the events of 9/11, and the plane crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone. And we're really glad to be able to say that Professor Jim Fetzer will be joining us each month as a regular columnist. I met Jim, it was at the last anniversary of 9/11, I think it was. He was asked to speak at the Capitol in St. Paul, and I believe it or not, I was asked to go along to speak also. So I got a chance to do my thing there, and I got the chance to hear Jim Fetzer, and also Kevin Barrett was there. It was really a big thrill. I've been following the work of Jim Fetzer on the internet for quite a long time. His radio show is It's the Real Deal. You just look on, just Google Jim Fetzer, the Real Deal, and you'll get his radio show. He's been doing that for years and years. It was under different networks and different names. And what else is it? He also writes at Veterans Today, writes there quite a bit. And the thing is about Jim Fetzer is that's the cutting edge stuff, I think. He's the one who is writing the latest new article that you want to read to find out what's actually happening in the world. And I've said it before that, you know, if Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett could be the Huntley and Brinkley, just think of that on TV. Actually, the whole world would change. It really would. Give them a week or a month on national TV, on the news, and we would find out what's really happening in the world, and the world would change in that week or a month. I really believe that. And that's why, I don't know, it just kind of kicks home the reality that information is so important. It really is an information war. The evildoers who are not Korea and Iran and Iraq, there's someone and something else. They know that. The information wars are the cutting edge battle zone, as it were. And it does matter what we know. Knowledge is power. And the reason we're at such a disadvantage at this time and really having to rely on little radio shows like this is because someone with much wealth and power realized that. I think that in my own little theory is that the 1960s threw the right wing kind of off their game, and they decided that was never going to happen again. And so they have done everything from the Reagan, so-called Reagan Revolution, up to making sure that George Bush was elected twice. He was actually selected, not elected. But they've really done an end run around us, and we still don't have Jim Fetzer on the line. I know I did tell Jim it was to be around 7:10, but we're a little bit early here, so I'm going to go into my next bit and we'll come back, okay? Because I think Jim will call in, and my estimation was a little bit off. I think we'll find it'll work out. I'm going to go into number 9 here, Chuck. The Revenge of the Bedbugs, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. It means that anyone interfering with factory farms where pigs and other animals are crowded together in pens and pretty much driven crazy, because pigs are not stupid, anyone interfering with that is a terrorist. And then after we bloat the animals with toxins, drive these intelligent creatures crazy, we drive them into a big building and slice their throats, hang them from chains by their legs, cut them up, and then eat them. Recently, a truck driver from Ohio packing plant found a document apparently written by pigs whom he just had taken in for slaughter. It was written on nice animal stationery. It said on top, 4 legs good, 2 legs bad. The truck driver scanned down the paper and saw some big words and thought he had better turn it in, so he gave it to the slaughterhouse manager, who gave it to the manager of the cut floor, who passed it to the manager of the kill floor, who gave it back to the truck driver out hosing the blood from his truck in the parking lot, who sent it to his congressman, who made a law that anyone this smart, who cared about every living creature this much, was nuts and should be charged with terrorism. And they did that. They made the law to keep everyone safe from the smart ones who cared about every living creature. But by then, they were already dead. Now have a good night, and don't let the angry bed bugs bite. Chuck, do we have any word from Jim yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Go ahead and go on then.
Nebraska Inc. Amelia Earhart, tattoo artist of the Heartland. The locals know her as Babs. Her shop is on Main Street, between the barber shop and the cafe, with a picture of a floundering big plane atop the front door. She got off course, or she's hiding out, waiting for her chance to do what she was intended to do so long ago by FDR. Or maybe there was no spy mission for FDR, just a desire to fly around the world. She doesn't seem to care anymore. She just wants to be free to live out her days in Nebraska doing what she loves, talking about the color red, Cornhuskers, and making tattoos. Navigator Fred Noonan runs the front desk at the little tattoo shop. He's got his shirt up, his feet on the desk, his tongue sticking out, working on a full stomach tattoo of the Marshall Islands. "Hey, Fred," Amelia shouts from the back room. He knows what she's going to say, so he revs the motor high. Amelia's going to ask again what they were doing out in the Pacific, what FDR asked them to do, and how did they wind up in Nebraska. "Hey, Fred! Fred!" And was it all a dream? And what are they doing in Nebraska? Mystery, deceit, tattoos. Fred and Amelia and corn. It's all there waiting for you in the next episode of Nebraska Inc. Amelia Earhart, tattoo artist of the Heartland, Inc. It's in her blood. Is she lost? Is she hiding? All the other Nebraskans, why are they there? Are they lost? Are they hiding? Hiding from somebody, or something. Just why? Stay tuned for the next episode of Mount Liberty, Inc. Maybe then we'll all finally freaking find out.
Occupy Dealey Plaza. That's where it all began. November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m., 50 years ago this year, on November 22nd, 2013. Filled Dealey Plaza with protesters and signs and singing and speaking and let them bring their dogs and their cops and their robbers and murderers and their sniper rifles and double secret video cameras and microphones. Occupy Dealey Plaza. We demand a truth commission to replace the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission. We want freedom. We want peace. We want real hope and real change.
Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let them know we know what they have done. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let the world know this is America.
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. The attacks of 9/11 happened, which should seem like a long time ago, but it does not. It seems like yesterday. There are people still locked away in Guantanamo, war still being fought, people being killed, lies being told, new lies, old lies perpetuated and placed on monuments, all connecting in a straight line through the hearts of all of us right to that day, that morning. September 11th, 2001 happened everywhere, even in Mount Liberty, and now it can be told at least something of how it affected the lives of the people there, even though it seems not so long ago. The truth. The story of at least a few of the people who lived here during that time. Enough time for someone to be born and grow to high school age, enough time for those in high school at the time to have children of their own who don't have any reason to question. To ask questions, so we could be quiet and let them be comfortable in not knowing. We could do that. Some of us still hear the news reports of those days, quotes we read somewhere, playing in our minds like there is a radio somewhere turned to 12 years ago. You had to be there, as the saying goes, to understand what it was like. Kate Smith on the radio, George Bush on the TV, the towers coming down. There is a radio on somewhere. I hear it. Can't you hear that? We look. We have to look. You always look. Trust yourself. You know more than you think you do, Dr. Benjamin Spock.
The car stopped. A small white domestic with rust in the wheel wells, slowly rolling to a halt at the stop sign, but not in front of the sign. Rather behind it, perpendicular, at odds with the sign. The car sat with two tires halfway covered by the ditch brome grass. A man pulled himself out of the driver's door and walked around the back of the car, carrying something flimsy in his hand, pinching it with two fingers as the breeze caught it. He stood next to the sign, judging his height by it, looking down the old dirt road to where it was forced to climb a short hill, where the aged path that once grew ancient, with grass down its middle like an old man's eyebrows and unchecked tufts on both sides. The man, wearing a t-shirt, tennis shoes, and green shorts to his knees, took two steps to put himself in front of the stop sign. He raised the bumper sticker to eye level and concentrated on tearing off the backing, letting the two slick slips drift into the grass. Carefully, he raised the red sticker with white letters to the stop sign and smoothed it diagonally across the T and the O, then moved back, careful not to step down into the ditch. "We're being lied to," the man read without moving his lips. The smell of hogs rode the breeze. He looked up at the sound of barking geese, tried to locate the V. He took one step forward to reach up and attempt to smooth the bubble in the middle of the sticker.
Secrets love to whisper.
At the sound of a helicopter's blades, without looking up, the man strode deliberately to his car. Way out here, that noise only meant someone being rushed to the city hospital after a car crash, a heart attack, or a tractor rollover. He got in, started it up, and pulled onto the gravel, gradually accelerated, and felt the pedal pull away from his foot to the floor. The man's mouth and eyes went wide as he scrambled to find the cruise control. Keeping one white hand on the wheel, he stretched and clawed down to try to pull the pedal from the floor. The speedometer climbed to 60, 70, then 85 as the car approached an old wooden bridge on a curve. The man tried to push the door open as he fought to stop the car by squeezing the steering wheel and soiling his clothes.
Cooper Light strode furiously through the nursing home, stuffing folded newspapers between the doorknobs and the frame, trying to get his route done before school. His two hands worked in tandem, ripping out the favorite grocery ad, stuffing them into his paper bag, then twisting the papers to fit. Stupid old people, he thought, with their flags scotch-taped to the doors and a postcard saying, God bless America. Sits and does not move, plays cards alone in the dark, walks away and cannot return. Cooper played his game of making up Indian names for white people. He had delivered the daily paper for over 2 years now, since just before the September 11th attack. Cooper had read the propaganda headlines, and he had scanned the underground websites on his computer at home, jammed into the corner, surrounded by boxes like Oswald's sniper nest. And he had fought to understand how the editors of the paper he worked for could claim to live in the same world. Nothing ever printed about the new pipeline through Afghanistan, the murder of Paul Wellstone, or the government manipulation of the Trade Center debacle. Bushes and Cheney probably planned the whole thing years ago. How did it happen that the two towers came down almost together, symmetrically, in a heap, like when a building is taken down by dynamite? I'm not getting no freaking smallpox shot. That's just what they want. Fill you full of some Soma Prozac cocktail, and then, this is perfect, the sick fucks, when you refuse to get the shot, they put you in a detention camp, quarantine, for your own safety and the good of the community. Just like on the day that 9/11 happened, Phil Berrigan was in federal prison for beating a hammer on a nuclear submarine or something, you know, and they put him in isolation for his own safety. Yeah, right. As if he ever was afraid or had any reason to be afraid. The other prisoners would not have taken out some misplaced patriotism on him. They knew what time it was. It was because he was a threat to the system, a leader, and they fear leaders like me.
Cooper rolled the paper into a tight tube and placed it expertly at room 419. Without thinking, he grabbed the next paper from his bag, walked down the carpeted walkway, and again thought about what had happened way back then. Cooper had been sitting in the hall at St. Rose Middle School, on the wooden bench left over from the middle school intellectual purges of the McCarthy days. He sat with his legs crossed at the ankles, hands folded in his lap, trying to look unconcerned, watching the sweeping hand on the hall clock, listening to Mrs. Feenstra's English class, smelling the lasagna from the cafeteria. Mr. Schmidt walked by in his gym clothes, whistle round his neck, staring at Cooper's t-shirt, then shook his head at the floor as he kept marching. Cooper put his chin to his chest to again read the shirt, the reason for his being on the pine outside the principal's office. The shirt was white with a ketchup stain on the breastbone, surrounded by a penumbra of water from the fountain where Cooper tried to rub it out. Underneath the stain was a black picture of President Bush with the crosshairs on the forehead, and below it, "Not my president." And so, as soon as Cooper walked into Mr. Freeman's room that morning wearing the same shirt that Freeman had told him yesterday not to wear to school again.
People need to ask themselves, would evil men kill to gain absolute power?
Writing on the chalkboard. He stalked toward Cooper, gripped him tightly by the shoulder, and said, "You're coming with me." Freeman pushed on Cooper's shoulder to tell him to sit on the old wooden bench as he walked into Mr. G's office. Now they were in there talking as the stairs around the corner began to click, and then men in suits came around the corner and down the dark hall. Cooper recognized them as the two who sat in the light blue Mustang outside his house every day. They studied Cooper as they touched their ties and buttoned their jackets to enter the principal's office. After the cooks had left the cafeteria to go drive the bus, and Mrs. Feenster told her class to read silently while she strode out of her room to jog in the restroom, Cooper was called inside. He was hustled past Miss Johnson's secretary table to Mr. G's office, where Cooper sat in an orange plastic chair, while Freeman and Mr. G and the two FBI agents sat on the edge of Mr. G's historic desk, gripping the wood with just the edge of their butts. All so long ago, it seemed. Now Cooper headed down the retirement home hall, lit only by the 15-watt bulbs over each door, to his last drop. He turned at the turnaround door and headed back. Oswald's chin, he thought. What an obvious crop mark on that photo, the one in the backyard holding the rifle. Cooper's dad had showed him the picture in Life magazine, took him to the library just to show him. Someone had taken a razor blade, put somebody else's body under Oswald's face, and cut at the chin. And they put it on the front page of Life freaking magazine. Who would want to do that? Who could do it? So that the photo was all ready for sending out, minutes after Kennedy was shot in the head and dead. That obvious crop mark, that's what they call him. Crop marks, not corn, but where it's cut, see? Then none of this out here is what it seems, see?
For those of us who were alive on 22nd November 1963, it remains forever a current event embedded in our memories. I was a 10-year-old boy at the time. That fall day defined the beginning of a turbulent era whose ripples continue to be felt today throughout our government and the nation's psyche. A faith and trust in government was lost that the truth can only restore.
Well, that's what Cooper's dad had tried to explain that one day. That it's possible nothing we think we know about Mount Liberty is true. Cooper tried to get his dad to tell him the truth. Is the library really the dentist office then, he asked? Is the ball field really a tennis court? But his dad just shook his head, annoyed that his boy didn't get it. So Cooper was pretty sure he got it now. Nothing about this picture is true. There's a wizard somewhere pulling levers behind the curtain. But where is the curtain? He wished he could ask his dad that. Maybe we didn't really win the state championship. Maybe it's all a dream or somebody's made-up story that never ends. Cooper did not want to think about that. Gave him a headache. Just like thinking about being in heaven forever. Think about it. Never ending. Even if it's good. Eating strawberry ice cream forever. Playing baseball in the park on a nice day. But forever? That's scary. Right? Scary. Like thinking that the men who sit in front of Cooper's house to keep his dad from coming home... We're now after him, too. Well, all right then. Maybe it was because Cooper and his dad knew the secret that somebody chopped off Oswald's chin. Me and Dad, bring it on, you stupid freaking assholes. Cooper picked the flag off its little mount on room 342, stuffed it into his paper bag, then dropped the flag in the green garbage can on the other side of the big glass doors.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
Well, it's just great to be here, and remarkably coincidental that you're talking about the faking of the Oswald backyard photographs, because I've just returned from the third Hollywoodism film conference held in Tehran, Iran, during which my own presentation was the use of Hollywood-style special effects, including optical printing, in relation to JFK and other types of special effects in relation to 9/11. It was a fascinating conference with 50 experts from around the world, including Rodney Shakespeare from Indonesia, Thierry Maison from France, Ken O'Keefe from Ireland, Art Olivier from the USA, Talib Warsi from the UK, Senator Mark Gravel from the USA, William Rodriguez from the USA, Kevin Barrett from the USA, where Kevin has a wonderful article about this conference, Iran Drops Bomb on Hollywood. We were discussing the role of Hollywood in affecting culture and presenting views that are really predominated by promoting the interests of Israel and Zionism. Typical familiar examples include Schindler's List, Sophie's Choice, The Reader. Many have been very candid about the fact that Hollywood is dominated by those who are Jewish and are promoting an Israeli agenda. We also talked about Zero Dark 30, Flight 93, Taken 2, and other examples of biased depictions of either the events of 9/11 or of Israel, Arabs being cast in an unflattering light. But my own presentation included, in relation to JFK, a discussion of how the Zapruder film had been altered using special effects optical printing, whereby you can combine any foreground with any background, and how the virtually motionless spectators we see watching as the presidential limousine suddenly springs into view appears to have been taken from footage that was actually filmed earlier before the president had arrived, and how the limousine stop, one of 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up for the hit, had to be removed because it was such an obvious indication that this was an inside job, where after William Greer, the driver, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt, JFK was hit twice in the head, once from behind, he fell forward, Jackie eased him back up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible or exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out to the left rear with such force that when they hit Officer Bobby Hargis riding there, he initially believed he himself had been shot. In order to conceal this, they removed the limo stop and also the activities of Clint Hill, which he has consistently described for nearly 50 years now, as rushing forward, getting on the back of the limousine, pushing Jackie down, laying across their bodies, peering down into this fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head, turning and giving his colleagues a thumbs down, all before reaching the triple underpass, which Roy Kellerman in the passenger seat in the presidential limousine confirmed during his testimony to the Warren Commission when he reported looking back and seeing Clint Hill lying across the trunk. It was actually the back of the seat, but from his perspective, it appeared to be the trunk, all before reaching the triple underpass. They also took out Officer James Cheney riding on the right side, motoring forward to notify Chief of Police Jesse Curry that the president had been shot, where Curry was in the lead car with Forrest Sorrells and Winston Lawson, who had been involved in setting up the motorcade route, and was also confirmed by yet another motorcycle patrolman. Yet none of that appears in the extant version of the Zapruder film. Indeed, we have more than 60 witnesses who report the limousine having either dramatically slowed or come to a complete halt, where it dramatically slowed as it came to a complete halt. They also patched up the wounds. They changed the president's motion to introduce that violent to the left rear motion, which no witness reported. They painted in a bulge, seeming bulging brains out to the right front, and a blood spray, which was detected initially by Roderick Ryan, as an expert in special effects, when he was consulted by Noel Twyman in the preparation of his magisterial work, Bloody Treason, published in 1997, who explained to Noel that those features had been painted in to create the impression of the effects of a shot fired from behind. They also altered the X-rays to conceal the massive blowout at the back of the head, for which there was witness after witness after witness. It had occurred to me that in spite of their efforts of painting over that blowout in the crucial frames 316, 313, 14, 15, 16, 17, and so forth, that they might have overlooked that it could still be seen in later frames. And I discovered in frame 374, you can actually see the blowout. When you compare the blowout to the area of the X-ray that was patched, which David W. Mantic, MD, PhD, defined using a technique from physics known as optical densitometry, they're both very similar in their appearance. I've written about that. You can see the frame in JFK, Who's Telling the Truth, Clint Hill, or the Zapruder film. I've written about James Cheney motoring forward in More Proof of JFK Film Fakery. Another relevant article is Did Zapruder Film, the Zapruder Film, to which the answer is perhaps initially surprisingly no, for the reason that no one films a fake film. This was actually created in the laboratory in a special secret lab run by the CIA in Rochester, adjacent to Kodak headquarters there. The original of the film was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center on Saturday, the 23rd. It was an 8mm already split film that had been developed in Dallas. Sunday, the substitute was brought to the same location. It was a 16mm unsplit film that had been developed in Rochester. In addition to those sophisticated techniques, a very famous photograph of the assassination taken by AP photographer James Ike Alchins, showing the president clutching his throat from a shot that has passed through the windshield, where the windshield is also, the bullet hole in the windshield is also visible in the photograph. In the background in the doorway is a figure whose identity has been widely disputed, which was initially believed to have been, or claimed by the government to have been, Billy Lovelady, a co-worker of Lee Oswald, but who many have believed was Lee Oswald himself. We have discovered multiple indications of film fakery in that area. A man's face has been obliterated. The doorman's left shoulder is missing. A figure beside him, to whom we refer as Black Tie Man, is both in front of him and behind him at the same time. Clearly an impossibility, and based upon a meticulous study of the shirt and the T-shirt he is wearing, as well as comparison of features of the cranium, the left eye, the right ear, and so forth, we've been able to establish that that actually is Lee Oswald, which means not only was he not the lone assassin, he wasn't even a shooter. No one can be in two places at the same time. Lee was actually in the doorway as the motorcade passed by, not on the sixth floor. That the government has gone to such extraordinary lengths to conceal the truth about the assassination of JFK is because the government itself was profoundly involved. For those who want more about JFK, I have two recent studies online entitled JFK Part 1, A National Security Event, Oswald Didn't Do It, and JFK Part 2, A National Security Event, How It Was Done, in which I explained that there were actually shooters at six different locations, that JFK himself was hit four different times, Connally anywhere from one to three, where at least three shots missed, which means there were eight, nine, or ten shots fired altogether. This is just one more indication of the extent to which the American government is willing to lie to the American people. The CIA was worried Jack was going to shatter it into a thousand pieces. The Joint Chiefs believed he was betraying the nation because he had not invaded Cuba. Contrary to their unanimous recommendation, he had gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty. Contrary to their unanimous opposition, now he was pulling our forces out of Vietnam, where they felt a stand had to be taken against the expansion of international godless communism. The Eastern bankers were upset because Jack was circumventing the Fed. He had already instructed the Treasury Department to publish tens of millions of United States notes, believing it was absurd for the government of the United States to pay interest to a private consortium banks to print the money of the United States. The mafia was upset with Jack because Bobby was cracking down on organized crime for the first time, bringing in massive indictments and prosecutions and convictions. And the Texas oilmen were upset because he was threatening to cut the oil depletion allowance, which they regarded as akin to their divine right. Lyndon Johnson forced himself on the ticket when Bobby made a pro forma invitation to run with Jack in the belief that, of course, as the powerful majority leader, he would decline. Instead, he left on it with information from J. Edgar Hoover about a dalliance Jack had had with a beautiful woman who turned out to be an East German spy. He threatened to reveal that Jack had Addison's disease, which meant he wasn't going to live a long life. And he promised Bobby that if he were not on the ticket, that any legislative proposal sent down from the White House would be dead on arrival, where he as the legislative majority leader would block them. It is a stunning situation where you can read about how Jack antagonized the most powerful interests in the country in James Douglas's magnificent book, JFK and the Unspeakable, and then what they did about it in Phil Nelson's important book, LBJ Mastermind of JFK's Assassination. It is among the darkest, blackest, deepest tragedies, a deep abyss in American history, I'm sorry to say, and it's taken us nearly 50 years to sort it out.
Thank you, Jim, for a stirring and enlightening commentary. We appreciate having you on our show.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so very much.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back again next week, same time, same place. I'd like to thank WorldNewsTrust.com for hosting our website and James Boomey of June2508.com for his generous contribution to keep the show going. I'd like to thank all of you, and I'd like to thank my co-host, Mike Palachuk. Thank you and good night, Mike.
Chuck, stay warm, and good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh, and good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.